And then I heard these footsteps in my kitchen. I didn't dare move. I hardly dared breathe. It could have been me, couldn't it?
What is it, Paul?
It's someone's hand.
It's someone's hand.
She must have had a weak heart, poor old girl. I had to stop her screaming, but I didn't mean to kill the old girl. You know what it is when a woman screams.
Murder Most Foul. 6 forensic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 6, The Use of Maggots.
Anyway, let's keep our eyes out for maggots. Why do maggots make such good bait?
Well,
I suppose it...
Look at that.
God, there's thousands of them.
Hey, there's even more under here, look.
Oh, it doesn't have to stink.
I wonder what it was.
Give us a hand room, some of this stuff. We'll have enough maggots to keep us fishing in here. I've never seen
what's that.
What is it, Paul? It's someone's hand. It's someone's hand.
So it was that two boys came across a partly buried, decomposing corpse in Bracknell Woods. Had they not been in those woods that Sunday morning in June 1964, looking for maggots, then perhaps the body and the murder would never have been uncovered. The two boys were soon at Bracknell Police Station, and it wasn't long before the woods were swarming with photographers, fingerprint takers, investigating officers, and the Home Office pathologist. The police team was led by Detective Superintendent Arthur Lawson, head of Berkshire CID. The pathologist was Professor Keith Simpson. He was, in fact, embarking on what was to become one of the most celebrated cases of his career.
Hot for this sort of work, Professor.
The maggots like it.
Managed it. We've got a print.
Well, the finger pads are peeling off, but we may have got something that's usable.
Good. And what can you tell us, Doctor?
Well, male. I'm not sure how he died yet.
And how long's he been here? 6, 8 weeks?
Excuse me, sir. We found where he took the earth from to cover the body. There's pieces missing from the verge back at the main road.
Right.
But the sprays of beechwood that were on top of there, we haven't been able to find anything like them.
Don't you ever walk in these woods, Constable?
No, sir.
Well, you should. They're beautiful. But they don't have any beech trees in them. None at all.
So, they must have been brought here.
Very good, Constable. And it probably means that he wasn't murdered here, either. He was brought here after he was killed.
No, not 6 or 8 weeks.
Sorry?
How long has he been here? I'd say more like 9 or 10 days.
What? You sure?
Well, he's fairly well gone, I agree. But how long has that taken? Is he trying to work out loss of body temperature? Is no use to us now, is it? There's more heat in the maggots themselves than the body.
Well, what about rigor mortis?
That will have been and gone a good while back. No, I'm looking at the maggots.
The maggots?
And I'd say that he died at the most 12 days ago. Once they get going, these little fellows can eat up a body in next to no time. I've seen a body brought to this state in 10 days. So I'd say he died around about the 16th or 17th.
Would you now, Professor?
I would.
Superintendent Lawson then phoned the Missing Persons Bureau at Scotland Yard. A man called Peter Thomas, it turned out, had gone missing from his home in the village of Lydney in Gloucestershire on the 16th of June. And Detective Superintendent Faber of Scotland Yard had been in Gloucestershire helping the local police. The remains had been found over 140 miles from the home of Peter Thomas, but the corpse bore similar characteristics, and Faber wanted to come and see the body for himself. By the end of the afternoon, there he was, in Bracknell Woods.
Well, I'd say you've collected just about everything you could without moving the body, so it's about time to move it. All right by you, Professor?
Yes, that's fine.
Superintendent?
I think so. Sergeant, I want the photographer to take pictures at every stage as the body is disinterred.
Yes, sir.
Oh, and I'd like some samples of the maggots, please.
Sorry?
In a jar.
Oh.
So, very carefully, the body was moved. Neither a pleasant nor an easy job. As the neck came into view, so too did a small pool of blood, just to the left of the voice box. The little bones of the larynx had been crushed on that side. Professor Simpson picked them out, loose, one by one.
Well, this can't have done his voice any good. But then I shouldn't think he used it again.
So that's what killed him?
I'd say so. A violent blow across the throat.
Definitely a blow.
Definitely. Not a violent constriction, a blow.
And what sort of blow?
Ah, now that's harder to say. Could have been a punch, or a kick, or even a bottle. Whatever it was, if it caused this sort of injury, he'd very probably have bled in the throat, and then he'd have breathed in the blood.
Yeah.
He'd have been dead in a few minutes.
Back at the mortuary, the parts of the body were painstakingly reassembled. Professor Simpson carried out his post-mortem, and then discussed his findings with Detective Superintendent Faber.
Well, I make his height 5'3". Oh. How tall was your Peter Thomas?
5'3" or 4".
Mm-hmm. And I put his age at between 40 and 50.
Thomas was 42.
As to dental data, well, he clearly never took any care of his teeth. I shouldn't think he ever went to a dentist. So that's no use.
I've been told he once broke his left forearm.
Ah, well, there's nothing showing. I need his x-rays.
Were there any other injuries, apart from the throat?
Well, nothing very serious. Some discoloration over the breastbone and some blood over the tissues there, too. Yeah. So perhaps that was from bruising of the chest.
Struggle, maybe?
Maybe. But his brain was liquid, of course, by the time we got to it, so I couldn't tell you whether he had any other blow that might have made him unconscious.
Mm.
Well, anyway, the blow to the throat could well have done the trick by itself.
Mm.
So, who was he, this Peter Thomas, if that's who this man is?
A bit of an oddball, really. A recluse. He lived in a bungalow, well, hardly more than a shack, out in the sticks. No mod cons and just his dog for company. He drew the dole, lived as if he was penniless, though he can't have been. His father left him £5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we found some letters in his house about him having lent £2,000 to a William Brittle from Hampshire.
A relative?
A stranger. Brittle advertised in the paper, said he could offer a quick return for an agricultural prospect. We've spoken to Thomas's bank manager and his solicitor, and they both advised him against making the loan, but he went ahead and did it anyway. 12.5% for 6 months. The loan was meant to be repaid when...
Thomas went missing.
When Thomas went missing.
And have you seen this, Mr. Brittle?
Oh, I've seen him. I'm going to see him again.
Detective Superintendent Faber did indeed visit Brittle again, but by now convinced that the dead man was Peter Thomas. The x-ray of the victim's arm showed a fracture, and there was conclusive proof. The disintegrating fingertips had yielded usable fingerprints, and they matched prints on police files which came from Peter Thomas. Faber visited William Brittle at his 15th century farmhouse near Hook in Hampshire.
Look, I've said I'll help in any way I can, but I really don't see why you want to look at my car again.
Just to be able to eliminate you from inquiries, Mr. Brittle. We'll only keep it a day or two.
Oh, this is ridiculous.
Do you mind if I come in, Mr. Brittle?
Oh, looks as though you're going to anyway.
You see, in the letter you sent to Mr. Thomas, you claimed some sort of friendship with Viscount Folkestone, didn't you?
I may have done.
No, Viscount Folkestone, he's the heir to Lord Radnor, isn't he? Very impressive. May I sit down?
Oh, carry on.
But I'm afraid we've been in contact with Viscount Folkestone. And you're not a friend of his, are you, Mr. Brittle?
Well, sometimes you've got to stretch things a bit, haven't you?
Yes, of course. But you weren't just stretching things, Mr. Brittle. You were inventing them, just as you invented being a captain in the army.
Well, what's it matter? All right, so you've got to seem well-connected at times. That's how the world is. It's not my fault. But as to Thomas, I told you, I went down to Lydney on the 16th of August. I paid him his £2,000, and that's the last I saw of him.
£2,000 plus the interest.
Oh, of course, plus the interest.
Which was £125.
And I gave him an extra £25 on top, for being a bit late.
Oh, that's right. Very generous of you. So, that's £2,150. A lot of money to pay back.
Oh, it's what I agreed.
Indeed. And what had you borrowed the money for in the first place?
Well, I do have other business interests.
And debts, I believe.
A few of them, yes.
Which you paid off with the loan. So how did you pay back Mr. Thomas?
Well...
Did you borrow from someone else, perhaps?
It came in bits and pieces, you know. Nothing you could put your finger on.
Over £2,000. In bits and pieces. A few years' wages for us ordinary folk, Mr. Brittle. And despite this beautiful house, I believe your salary is a heating engineer salesman, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. I believe your salary is not more than average.
Yet over £2,000 comes in and you can't put your finger on how.
I won a lot of it on the races.
Ah, oh, really? You're a lucky man. So which horses did you win on?
I'm not very good at remembering that sort of thing.
Oh, come on. One horse? Just one winner?
It was an accumulator, a roll-up system at the races.
Ah, can I tell you what, Mr. Brittle? I find it hard to believe you.
Well, I'm telling you the truth. And about when I went to see Thomas that day, I picked up a hitchhiker. So he'll be able to tell you.
I hope we can trace your hitchhiker. And the bookmakers where you won these enormous amounts of money. Because otherwise you might be in some trouble, Mr. Brittle.
Not only Brittle's car, but also his shoes and clothing were all minutely examined. A blood stain was found on a jacket sleeve. It was blood group O, the blood group of the dead man, but that was also the blood group of Brittle himself. In the car, nothing was found, not a drop of blood, not a clod of earth, nothing. Nothing, that is, except for a single leaf nestling under the driver's mat. It was the leaf from a beech tree. There were no beech trees in the area of Brittle's home. The superintendent visited a Mr. Worsley, a former warrant officer.
Yes, I remember him. Cold sort of fella. Not all that popular with the lads.
And you were in charge of his unit?
In charge of the physical training of his unit, yeah.
Ah.
And they needed it, I can tell you. Bodies made of jellies before I got hold of them.
Did you teach them any karate?
Karate? No, that's not the way we do things.
None at all?
Well, the chop, of course, that comes in useful.
Could that be fatal?
Oh, yes. You could kill a man with that.
Then there was the hitchhiker that Brittle said he'd picked up. The story turned out to be true. The man was traced. He was a golf caddy, and he confirmed Brittle's story, that he'd been to Lydney on that day. Now, would a murderer have stopped to give a hitchhiker a lift while he had a corpse in the boot? Possibly, but he'd have to be a very cool killer indeed. For months, Faber patiently put together whatever scraps of evidence he could about Brittle's debts and problems with his mortgage repayments, about his arrears on insurance premiums, about his having once scornfully referred to betting on horses as a mug's game. The case was still very much alive. But then, disaster seemed to strike. Detective Superintendent Faber paid a visit to Professor Simpson's laboratory at Guy's to tell him the bad news.
So, what's the problem?
A man called Roberts is the problem, Dennis Roberts.
And?
He says he saw Peter Thomas alive on the 20th of June.
What?
He says he was looking at the timetable in the bus station of Gloucester. But the 20th of June, Doctor, that's 4 days after Brittle went to Lydney. 4 days after he was meant to have killed Thomas.
What do you know about Roberts?
Oh, I know what you're thinking. But I haven't any reason to doubt him. He's a perfectly respectable fellow, a nylon spinner, an acquaintance of Thomas.
Well, if he's not lying, he's mistaken.
And if he's telling the truth and he is not mistaken, the whole case against Brittle collapses.
I realize that. But Thomas was not alive on the 20th.
Well, if I'm to convince the DPP, I'm going to need that in writing. Would you do that for me?
Of course. As being wholly inconsistent with my findings. Could you read that back to me, Jean?
I have today been shown by Detective Superintendent Faber a copy of a statement made by Dennis John Roberts to the effect that on Saturday, 20th of June, he saw a man whom he recognized as Peter Thomas at a bus station. The condition of the body when examined in the ward on 28th of June precludes this possibility in my view. I have had considerable experience in the timing of death and would regard Dennis Roberts' statement as being wholly inconsistent with my findings.
Thank you, Jean. Do you think that'll do?
I don't know. If it's one piece of scientific evidence, and a pretty novel piece at that, against a statement from an unbiased witness...
We know nothing about whether the witness is unbiased or not.
So we can assume him to be unbiased.
Yes, all right, then. People's memories are fallible.
And isn't science?
Not this bit of science. Maggots are susceptible to scrupulous investigation just as much as any other phenomena.
But it's hard to make the findings sound quite as respectable.
I'd just like to be given the chance.
But it seemed the professor wasn't going to be given the chance. The director of public prosecutions considered the matter for some weeks, took the opinion of senior counsel, and then decided that the prosecution case just wouldn't stand up in court. Bitterly disappointed, all Faber could do now was submit the case to the coroner at Bracknell and have the inquest jury hear the evidence. Though it could hardly be expected that a coroner's jury would commit Brittle for trial when the Director of Public Prosecutions had decided not to do so. For 7 days, the inquest listened to the evidence, including new witnesses who said they'd caught sight of Thomas after June the 16th. William Brittle declined to give evidence himself, though on his behalf it was stated that he had posted a receipt for the repaid money to Mr. Thomas's solicitors. The time came eventually for the coroner, Mr. Wellbelove, to sum up, and some of his directions to the jury could not have been expressed more clearly.
If you are satisfied he was murdered by a particular person, you must return a verdict against that person and name him. Mr. Brittle is said to have told detectives that he repaid £2,150 in cash on June the 16th, the day Thomas disappeared, and posted a receipt to Thomas's solicitors. That there were certain discrepancies in letters from Mr. Brittle when negotiating the loan. A great deal of evidence concerning the transaction has been given. Mr. Brittle was summoned to give evidence here as a witness, but on the advice of his solicitor, he decided he would not. He was perfectly entitled to come to that decision. You must not let that weigh with you, one way or the other, when you're considering this matter. We come to the matter of that receipt. You may think that that was rather a curious proceeding. After getting the receipt from Mr. Thomas, Mr. Brittle decided to make a photocopy, then have a copy made of that copy, made by a woman at his office. Then he also took the rather strange course of sending the original to Thomas's solicitors. They never received it.
The jury retired for an hour and 20 minutes. Had those who claimed to have seen Thomas after June the 16th been mistaken, or was the pathologist wrong? What significance could be given to a single leaf from a beech tree? And what about the receipt? If Brittle really did have a receipt, why hadn't he simply kept hold of it? Why on earth post it to Thomas's solicitors? And why did they never receive it? And photocopies, of course, are much easier to forge than our originals.
Our verdict is that death took place in between June 16th and June 17th, 1964, in the area of Peter George Thomas's property, and that he died by violence inflicted by a third party in accordance with medical evidence given, and that it was murder by Mr. William Francis Brittle.
Is that the verdict of you all?
It is.
Chief Inspector Jones, will you take Mr. Brittle into custody and remove him from the court, and see that he's confined until you receive my warrant.
So, the jury at a coroner's inquest had managed what the DPP had not, to commit Brittle for trial on a charge of murder. It was no surprise that within the hour, Brittle's solicitor, Mr. Gibbons, applied to the High Court for a writ of certiorari, seeking to quash the jury's decision, mainly on grounds that the verdict was against the weight of evidence. But the application was rejected. Brittle must face trial. The case was heard at Gloucester Assizes. The defence was conducted by the renowned Mr. Quintin Hogg, QC, later to become Lord Hailsham, the Lord Chancellor. The prosecution was well matched, led by the wily Queen's Counsel, Ralph Cusack. The final witness for the prosecution was Professor Simpson. Knowing that the defence had their own expert witness to call soon, this precise man was well aware that he must be particularly precise this time in his evidence.
Could you tell us, Professor, how it was that you calculated the time of death to have been at least 9 or 10 days previous to the discovery of the body in the woods?
Yes. In some circumstances, loss of body temperature can be sufficient for such a calculation, but this body was well past that stage. And similarly, rigor mortis was no longer going to be of any assistance.
So how did you calculate it, then?
By the maggots I found feeding on the body. They were larvae of the bluebottle Calliphora erythrocephalus.
Are you certain of that?
Yes. I preserved examples to have them checked.
Carry on, then, please.
Well, the ordinary life history of the bluebottle is quite simple. The eggs are laid in daylight, usually sunlight, and it is accepted that in warm weather they hatch on the first day. The tiny first instar maggot sheds its skin after 8 to 14 hours. The second instar after a further 2 or 3 days. The third instar, the fisherman's maggot,
the sort that the boys found, feeds voraciously for 5 or 6 days before going into a pupa state.
And were the maggots on the body in the pupa state?
No. They were mature, fat, third-stage maggots, but they were not in pupa cases.
So what did you conclude from this, Professor?
Adding a little time to allow for the blue bottles getting to the dead body, I had no doubt in my mind at the time that this man had been dead for some 9 or 10 days at the minimum.
Presenting the life cycle of maggots as crucial evidence in a murder trial was unprecedented. Quentin Hogg now produced the distinguished entomologist Professor McKenny Hughes, certainly a greater expert on the behaviour of bluebottles and maggots than even Professor Simpson. But it soon emerged he hadn't come to say what the defence had hoped he would.
Professor, you have heard the evidence given so far in this case. Will you kindly tell the court in what respects your views differ from those of Professor Keith Simpson?
Well, I'm not sure there's anything that I really...
Professor, can we agree about one thing? Let us suppose that the blue bottle lays its eggs on the dead body at midnight on the...
Oh, dear me, no. No self-respecting blue bottle lays eggs at midnight.
At midday, perhaps, but not at midnight.
Well, at midday, then.
At what period, Professor, would you expect the eggs to hatch?
Well, it all depends. You see, in warm weather...
Yes, Professor, we know it was June and quite warm. How many hours would elapse before the first maggots hatch?
Oh, well, I agree with Dr. Simpson on the times of hatching. Say, 8 to 14 hours for the first instar.
And these maggots, Professor, they would settle down on the dead tissues at once?
Well, maggots are curious little devils. Now, suppose this matchbox is the dead body, and suppose you have 100 maggots here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 99 of them will make their way towards the body, but the 100th little devil... He'll turn the other way.
It was a show of scrupulous impartiality. The witness may have been called by the defence, and it may have been a murder trial. But that wasn't going to affect either his lecture hall manner or his adherence to the facts. He finished up supporting the prosecution. But other defence witnesses were less easy to dismiss.
Yes, I knew him. We had worked together once at a sawmill.
Mm. And you saw him in Gloucester, you say, Mr. Roberts?
Yes, he was looking at the bus timetable in the bus station. I said hello to him, and he said, hello, Dennis.
Ah. And on what date was this?
Saturday, June the 20th. It's the only day I've ever been on strike, so I'm absolutely sure it was the 20th.
And how often would he come in?
Oh, quite often. Always on his own, of course.
And did he come in on Sunday, June the 21st?
Yes, he did. And I can tell you what for. He came in for some matches. He was always running out of matches.
Mm. And how do you know that date, Mrs. Padwick?
Because that's the very day my mother came to stay with us. Now, I'd remember that, wouldn't I?
Their evidence was convincing, and the prosecution had no way of discrediting it. All they could do was rely on the statements given by the pathologist and by the entomologist, who ironically had been called by the defence. Quentin Hogg summed up for the defence.
The financial aspect of the case provides both motive and opportunity. But I submit that you don't prove a charge of murder or anything else by proving opportunity or by suggesting that there is motive. What has got to be proved beyond reasonable doubt is not opportunity or motive, but the commission of the crime. Brittle is supposed to be able to fell like an ox at a single blow an open-air fellow defended by a dog. He is then able to make his car so chemically clean that all the microscopes, reagents and samples, all the lynx eyes of experienced police officers and forensic scientists, are unable to find the slightest trace of a body having been in the boot of the car. No, Brittle has not been connected with any evidence of violence. If Thomas was living after June 16th, it was not by the hand of Brittle that he met his death. And three witnesses have sworn that they saw Thomas alive and kicking 4 or 5 days after the prosecution alleged that he was dead. Professor Keith Simpson has failed to prove that Thomas died on June 16th. And if it was not established that the date of death was June 16th, although there may be motive, there is no opportunity.
Thomas was alive after June 16th. The hand that caused his death was not that of Brittle.
Quentin Hogg had done all he could. Then, rather like the coroner before him, the judge, Mr. Justice Phillimore, summarised with a tone of clear detachment, while gently implying, perhaps, how he viewed the case himself.
If a man is proved to be unscrupulous or a liar, you don't infer from that that he is necessarily also a murderer. It may seem odd to you that a man working so many miles away from Glidney, Gloucester, where Thomas lived, travelled there to repay him by cash when he could have sent a cheque. If you think that this story, in the light of the evidence, is moonshine and an insult to your intelligence, then you may conclude that this man did not have this very large sum from winnings on horses.
William Brittle was found guilty of murder and sentenced to life imprisonment. The first man, but not the last, to be convicted on the evidence of maggots.
In The Use of Maggots, Keith Drinkle played Dr. Keith Simpson and Steve Hodson played Detective Superintendent Faber. Other parts were played by John Evitts, David Sinclair, John Church, Federer Holmes, Jonathan Adams, Rachel Atkins, David Thorpe, Jilly Mears, Diana Payan, and John Fleming. Murder Most Foul was written by Rib Davis and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Hilary McLennan.